I'd like to talk with you about another aspect of nutrition. I'd like to talk with you about how to eat. There are ways that we eat that make it so that we cannot be so healthy as we could be if we ate in a proper way. Let me just point out the fact that many of us eat too fast, we eat too frequently, we eat too much. There are many things that we do that are incorrect that if we did them differently, it would be so much better for our health, so much better for the functioning of our metabolic systems. The controlling power of appetite will prove the ruin of thousands. When, if they had conquered on this point, they would have had moral power to gain the victory on every other temptation of Satan. And as we near the close of time, Satan's temptation to indulge appetite will be more powerful and more difficult to overcome. How important it is for us to understand that now we have far more temptations than we have ever had. Just think of the multiplied numbers of outlets to get McDonald's hamburgers or Dairy Queens or other things of this nature that tempt the appetite and yet have unhelpful things in them that can be a problem for the body to metabolize. To take the position that you cannot or will not change your lifestyle in response to the knowledge of the will of God is to take a position of death, as illustrated in the physiologic response. If we do not change when we have heart disease, we will die. That's illustrated by the South African dentist who received a new heart, and it was a beautiful new heart. Everybody who saw the new heart said it was a perfect specimen, and he was very fortunate to get this new heart. Yet he died 18 months later of a heart attack because of the fact that he had not changed his lifestyle. He kept on eating in the same way, not exercising, and because of that, he lost his new heart. We can do that too. So we need to frequently reevaluate what we're doing to see if there is something that we may not be doing correctly. So I'd like to talk with you about instructions on eating. Instructions on eating have very specific requirements. They're not very difficult to do. I think sometimes they are the most difficult things that we have to do, but actually to explain them, it's very simple to do. Probably the hardest thing in health reform is to learn to chew your food slowly. Chew your food slowly. But let's start with an understanding of how we can eat. Number one is what we should eat of. And the major thing that should comprise your dietary should be that of fruits and vegetables. These are the least concentrated of the foods that we eat, and along with that, grains taken in fairly generous quantities. This should make up the great bulk of what we eat, and anything else that is taken, no matter what it is, should be taken very sparingly. Now let's consider for just a moment some of the other things that we take other than fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. What are some other things that we take? Salt, somebody mentions, that's right. It isn't fruits, vegetables, or whole grains, is it? It is a refined product that we do find in fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, but it is not that, so it should be taken very sparingly. What else do we take? Sugar, okay? Somebody mentioned sugar. Sugar also is not fruits or vegetables or whole grains, and therefore it should be taken sparingly. Do you see the principle involved here? Whatever it is that is not fruits, vegetables, and whole grains should be taken sparingly, because those things that are concentrated or those things that are refined products represent a tax for the body to metabolize. And the greater the concentration, the greater the tax we're going to have in metabolizing. Nuts, all animal products, that would be meat, milk, eggs, and cheese. All other concentrated products, all fats, that would be all the free fats that are added, such as margarine, mayonnaise, fried foods, cooking fats, and salad oils. All of those should be taken very sparingly. If we understand how to do that, And that we should do it, it can make a great deal of difference in the way that we feel. Now we should have our fruits and vegetables and whole grains prepared in a tasty way. If our food is not tasty, then it will not be as good for us as it could have been if it had been tasty. You see, the body prepares itself depending on what it senses. It prepares itself to digest at a rapid rate, or it prepares itself to reject or even eject that has been eaten. And if what you have eaten just is halfway in between what is good and what is going to be ejected, the body is not going to be as interested in getting a good quality of digestion from that food. So remember that point. If food is not tastefully prepared, that is both tastefully so far as the way it is served as well as tasty in the way that it tastes, then the body is not going to be able to take that food so well. We refer to that not as health reform, but as health deform. We'd like to have you think in those terms also. Now, fruits that are used should be nicely ripened, but never spoiled. Now, you can tell when something is spoiled. It smells spoiled, tastes spoiled, looks spoiled. But if it is a little bruised, you may trim that part off, and then you may eat the rest. But if it is spoiled and smells spoiled and you cannot trim off that so that it does not smell, taste, or look spoiled, then it should be discarded. Now, there are some vegetables that even though they do not smell, taste, or look spoiled, they still may be spoiled. That would include green potatoes. When a potato has turned green, then discard that. It is no longer fit for you to eat. If a potato has been cut into by the digging tool, and the flesh of it has been injured, then you should throw that away also. After 2 or 3 days, it has produced enough of its natural insect repellent, which is a protective mechanism for itself to protect itself. It has produced enough of that to make it a cancer-producing agent for a human. So we should throw away those potatoes after they are 2 or 3 days old if the digging tool has actually injured it. And the wisest thing is when you're digging your potatoes, as soon as you have collected those that have been dug into, immediately cook those up and eat those first. If you will do so, that will keep the potato from developing that naturally occurring insecticide produced when the potato is injured. Now, the green on the outside does not represent the important injurious chemical. The green is merely chlorophyll, but at the time the potato is producing the chlorophyll, it is also producing a lot of solanine in the entire meat of the potato. So it is not adequate simply to trim the potato and eat the rest of it, but you should throw away the entire potato. So protect your potatoes, your Irish potatoes or white potatoes. Do not allow them to become green. Now the next thing is to vary your food from meal to meal. Do not eat the same thing unless you're in extreme poverty. I remember one time reading of a lady who lived around the turn of the century, Ellen White, who wrote in her diary that she ate tomatoes and vermicelli at one meal and greens and the English biscuit at another meal from February to June. But that was because of poverty and lack of availability of food. But we don't have that problem, do we? What we have now is the very reverse. We have the great problem of restricting our meals to that that can be simple enough so that it does not make us have allergies or stomach upsets or dullness of mind or a variety of other things that come, fermentation in the intestinal tract or other things that can come from our having eaten simply too many dishes. So we should keep both the meals, the menu that is, and the dishes simple. When you cook a dish, the more things you add to that dish, as you add one thing after another, everything that you add increases the unwholesomeness of the dish or decreases its wholesomeness. You may put one or two things in for flavoring, but then as you begin to add more things and chop up more things and add a great variety of things, fairly soon you have a complex mixture. Some people feel that when they make salads, the more things they put in the salad, the better it is. And so they put peppers, and they put olives, and avocado, and greens of various, five or six different kinds, and of course add a few beans, and then sprinkle some bako chips all over the top, and garnish all of that with some flowerettes of radishes, and maybe some slices of tomatoes, and we have a very complex mixture. Then the stomach must try to make order out of all of this chaos. And it would have been far better if we had served a lettuce salad. It can be served so that it is delightful. Or had served just a tomato salad. That also can be served so that it is delightful. Our fresh things do not need to be served in a complex jumble. Now, there are certain combinations that are more injurious than others. Milk, sugar, egg combinations are more injurious than almost any other kind of combination. Sugar and fat, these two represent sugar, fat, and high protein. These three, but especially sugar and fat, represent a very serious threat to the order of the metabolic systems. The milk, sugar, egg combination increases your risk of gallstones much more than any one of them alone, if you've just taken a larger quantity of any one alone, would do. The experience of the Eskimos shows that. We have a whole national experiment done with the Alaskan Eskimos to show us that gallstones, diabetes, acne, carious teeth, and a number of other degenerative diseases that represent a form of accelerated aging, that these occur more when we add sugar to an already fat diet. Now, the next thing is that of the way that we prepare our grains. Generally speaking, those grains that are boiled on top of the stove require long cooking. Let's take rice. Rice, grits, corn grits, whole kernel wheat or cracked wheat, these all require about 2.5 to 3 hours to completely hydrolyze the starches. Now, this is what you do. Take a pot, put the water on to boil, and put the grain in it. As soon as it comes to a boil after adding the grains, reduce the heat until you just get a small bubble, then put the lid on, and let it cook for 2.5 to 3 hours without disturbing it, unless you need to stir it, as would be the case with such things as cream of wheat or corn grits, which will make lumps if you don't stir it. So as soon as it gets so you don't have to stir it anymore, put the top on and don't touch it anymore for 2.5 to 3 hours. At the end of that time, then you are ready to serve. You don't have to attend it anymore. Just take it up and it's ready to serve. If you cook in a slow cooker or crock pot overnight, you can just take the whole crock pot when the breakfast is ready to be served, put that on the table, and you're ready to serve your breakfast. Now, what happens if you don't do things in this way? Well, we have some ill effects to the body that occur if we don't cook grains a long time. Some researchers about 10 or 12 years ago published a research paper that first came out in Medical Tribune, which is a little newspaper published in America, sent to most American physicians. And on the front page was the result of their experimental work. They had taken rats and fed them raw starch, raw potato starch. Grain starch does the same, apparently. What they found was this, that in the arteries of the brains of these rats, 3 days later, they would find a starch granule like this. The starch granule showed red blood cells back here behind it, indicating that the little blood vessel was entirely plugged up. And out here in the brain tissue itself was an exudate of white blood cells. Now, the white blood cells indicate an inflammatory reaction. This inflammatory reaction is a beginning abscess. Now, of course, this will resolve. In fact, the starch itself, starch granule, will gradually be hydrolyzed by the eating forces, the enzymatic forces of the blood. But this takes time, and during that time, there will be an inflammatory reaction. The researchers postulated that the rats, having suffered from this occlusion with the starch granule, that the rats would suffer from such things as dizziness and ringing in the ears, and that humans, if they had this same kind of thing, might have such things as headaches and dizziness and even allergies. In fact, one of the important theories that we have, that I have seen in places, indicates that one of the things that we can expect from improperly cooked grains is that we would develop allergies. And the commonest chronic disease in America today is that of allergies. And allergies are directly related in many instances to the way that we have eaten, to the time in life when we began to eat solid foods. It is better for us to take nothing but breast milk until we are about 6 months of age, and to introduce solid foods before that time, in many people, makes an appointment with an allergy at some later time in life, because of the fact that the immune system is injured by taking foods at too early a period in life. Taking of foods at too early a period in life does mean that instead of digesting the foods, we will take these foods into the bloodstream, and after we have taken them into the bloodstream, they go throughout the body, affect the immune system in such a way as to injure it and make it more susceptible to injury from other things that may also be floating around in the bloodstream. Now, with rolled oats, we have discovered here in our research that rolled oats do not finish hydrolyzing until they have cooked from 60 to 90 minutes on top of the stove. So put them on well in advance, and if you're not planning to get up in time to start the oatmeal 60 to 90 minutes before mealtime, then start them the night before in a slow cooker. Next thing is that of limiting rich foods, such things as sugar, fats, salt, and the like. And there are some things that we should avoid altogether. These should be greases and spices. Spices would include such things as ginger, nutmeg, cloves, cinnamon, and so forth. Many of these have been found to be cancer-producing. Pepper has been found to be cancer-producing. That would include cayenne, black pepper, red pepper, all kinds of pepper that feel hot in the mouth when they're not hot by heat. Those substances, those oils that irritate the tongue can also cause cancers, and not just stomach cancers, although they are very famous for causing stomach cancer and colon cancer, but cancers in other areas as well. Cinnamon has been found to be mutagenic. That means it causes permanent changes in chromosomes, and certainly no person before they have finished the childbearing age would want to risk any chromosomal damage of any kind. Now, we should eat at the same mealtime every day. Regularity in all things is essential, and in no place is that more important than it is in the way that we take out the time that we take our food. Now, mealtime can be set at whatever time is convenient for you. If it's convenient for you to have breakfast at, say, 7 o'clock in the morning, that's fine. And then your lunch should be no closer to your breakfast than 5 hours from the end of it. So if you end your breakfast at, let's say, 8:30, then the next meal that you take should be 5 hours from 8:30. Now, it won't hurt at all if you take it 6 hours from 8:30 or 7 hours. But if you take it 4, your body will not have had time to finish its digestion of your last meal. Now, it takes some 4 to 5 or 6 hours to empty the stomach of an ordinary meal, 4 hours, 3.5 to 4.5 hours for a small meal, and about 4 to 5 hours for a larger meal. And for a giant-sized meal, it might take 6 or 7 hours. And if you nibble between meals, then it may take you 15 to 20 hours to empty your stomach. This thing of eating between meals is an important problem that we have. Some x-ray studies have been conducted to determine the emptying time of the normal stomach, and we find some very important things. If a person has just a little bit of nibbling, it may require more time than he will be standing on his feet to empty his stomach. Now, once you lie down, then the emptying of the stomach requires a much greater length of time. When I was in my training in pathology at Emory University, one of the things that first struck me about doing the autopsy was that if we had an autopsy on someone who had died suddenly, let's say someone who was on his way to work, had a heart attack in his car, was found dead, and was brought in for an autopsy, one of the things that we discovered was the great number of these individuals who had died suddenly in the early morning who still had dinner types of foods in the stomach. Things like beans or chunks of pineapple. And many of these we would find whole beans in the stomach, whole raisins, whole chunks of pineapple, not even having one tooth dent in them. Now you might think, well, what poor table manners that person might have. Well, no, these were people like bank presidents or university professors and the like. These were not people who lived on the other side of the tracks, but were those that you would expect would have very good table manners, and yet they chewed very poorly. And then they went to bed very shortly after having eaten their meal. Therefore, the stomach did not empty. The increased tax of energy on the metabolic systems made it so that many of these people just passed over the line of what they could tolerate, and the blood coagulated in their narrowing arteries and made them have a heart attack. So during the night sometime, they closed off their arteries, and the muscle of the heart began to reduce its blood supply until the time finally came when the individual could no longer supply a sufficient quantity of blood to the muscle of the heart, and the heart simply began to develop what we call ectopic beats. That is, the rhythm of the heart was no longer regular, and suddenly the heart rhythm got so erratic that it just stopped. This kind of thing is not at all uncommon, and I believe an important precipitating factor is what is eaten and at what time one eats just prior to the onset of getting a fatal heart attack. Now, another important consideration is that of the interdigestive phase. I'd like to talk with you just a minute about the interdigestive phase. If you understand the stomach as being an integral part of the rest of the digestive tract, let's just take this kind of diagram. Here is the stomach, ending here in the small bowel like this, and then the large bowel coming around like this, and then picking up over here on the other side in this fashion. Now, this kind of thing that we have here is we can use to illustrate what happens when we eat a meal. We have food here, then pretty soon we have food in the small bowel. Then as the food moves down, it clears first the stomach and then the small bowel, so that the last little bit of food from the small bowel can be ejected into the colon in some 3 to 5 hours after we have taken our last meal. When the last little bit of food is ejected into the colon from the small bowel, then the stomach and small bowel will be empty. At that time, and not until the stomach and small bowel are entirely empty, but at that time we have a change in gear of our intestinal tract. We change the pattern of the motility. Instead of being short, quick peristaltic waves, we begin to have long, slow peristaltic waves. The entire purpose of peristalsis is different. Instead of trying to mix and move things along, now the purpose is cleansing. So long segments of bowel begin to have a very rhythmic type of peristaltic wave over it. The secretion is entirely different. The fluid shifts across the lining membranes and the walls of the intestinal tract. These are all quite different. So the fact that these processes go on were the subject of a good bit of investigative effort, and it was discovered that the purpose for these was cleansing, and that individuals who got them, who had these processes, had fewer cancers of the stomach and the colon, fewer problems with the colon such as gas and constipation, fewer stomach problems such as peptic ulcers and gastritis and indigestion, and fewer small bowel problems. Now, most Americans never get this interdigestive phase even one time. Do you know why? They are constantly snacking. Snacking between meals simply abolishes the interdigestive phase and makes it so that we cannot have this interdigestive phase, and therefore we lose its benefits. Now, which meal of the day should be your largest meal? Breakfast should be by far your largest meal. That is, if you're having three meals a day, breakfast should represent about half of what you eat, lunch should be about 40% of what you eat, and supper should be about 10%. 10% is a very small amount, something like one piece of fruit or one piece of bread, or if you're a very heavy laborer, maybe a piece of fruit and bread. Everyone must decide what his supper will be, what all of his meals should be. No one can tell you how much food you should eat. Everybody's metabolism is different. Some people can get by on a good bit less than others can, and we should get by on the least amount of food that we can. I like to describe that as the stair step level. Some of you may be aware of the fact that we have a plateau that we reach when we're losing weight. So let's say we lose weight and then we reach a plateau. And we can reduce food, and so forth, right on down to here. And it isn't until we reduce food to here, food intake, that we will lose more weight. So then with more and more food reduction, we will lose weight down to here. But then we reach another plateau. And then while we're on that plateau, we can continue to reduce food without much of any further reduction in weight until the time comes when we lose weight again. And we continue this kind of thing, the sort of stair step thing of losing weight. Now, we should all be living right on the edge of losing weight. If we reduce food anymore, we're going to lose weight again. Now, that's wherever you are. Whatever weight level you have decided is normal for you, and you want to keep that weight level, then live right there, so that if you reduce your food intake anymore, you're going to lose weight. That's the easiest for the body to handle, if you will do it in that way. You should eat all you need to maintain health. Scanty food will not maintain health. So we need sufficient quantity to maintain our health. We have been given a hearty appetite, and so we should eat a sufficient quantity. That kind of instruction that I just gave is hardly needed for most of us. Most of us need the other kind of instruction, and that is we should not eat too much. But the same one who said that we eat half to two-thirds more than we really need also said you cannot live on air merely. So let us remember that and eat heartily, but no more than we need. If you eat too much, that food will dull your mind and make it so that you have disease and fatigue, and it will shorten your life. We'll make it so that you cannot understand deep spiritual concepts. Now, what about chewing your food well? What benefits do we get from chewing your food well? I remember when I was in medical school, I was taught that since we evolved through the lower animal kingdom, that we didn't really have to worry too much about chewing our food very well, because of the fact that we had very powerful digestants, and these powerful digestants could just take very good care of any kind of digestive problem that we might present to the intestinal tract. So on that kind of thing, I went through my internship cultivating how fast I could gracefully eat a meal. Most of us in my internship had far more to do than we could get through in a day and half a night. So to save time at every possible turn was a real study. And one of the places was that of mealtime. So I got so that I could polish off enough food to maintain my weight in a flat 10 minutes and not appear to hurry. That is, nobody ever seemed to think that I was hurrying. But that, of course, meant that I swallowed a good bit of food nearly whole, something like those patients that we got in the early morning. But recent studies in science and those from the Inspired Pen show that we need to take lots of time to eat our meals. We need to take small bites, chew thoroughly, eat slowly. Those are three things that you should be constantly reminding yourself. Small bites, eating slowly, chewing well. Those three things. Now, studies done on the stomach show that if you have, let's say you're a person who takes two meals, but one you chew, the same meal, you take it on two different occasions, you chew it well one time, but the next time you don't chew it well, then this is what you have. Both, let's say this is the meal that you chew well, and this is the one you chew poorly. The one that you chew well, you'll produce X quantity of hydrochloric acid. The meal that you chew poorly, you'll produce the same amount, X quantity of hydrochloric acid. So whatever you produced when you chewed it well, you will produce the same quantity when you chew it poorly. So if we studied only that, we would say, well, it makes really no difference. We produce the same amount of hydrochloric acid, but we produce other things than that of hydrochloric acid in the stomach, and one thing that we produce is that of buffer. So let's say we produce Y quantity of buffer. Then the poorly chewed meal will be far less than that. Very little buffer in the poorly chewed meal. So if we don't have buffer, now a buffer substance is something to keep us from experiencing the full brunt of acid. So if we don't chew the food well, we won't produce enough buffer, and that will enable us to get a peptic ulcer very much quicker. So if you're working on a peptic ulcer, you know one way that you can do, that you can get one, and that is by not chewing your food very well. We should also not drink much liquid foods with our meals. Now, the liquid foods are soups, juices, and milks. And if we take a large quantity of liquid foods with our meals, this reduces the concentration of the stomach gastric juices. And the gastric juices need to be in concentration so that they can do the best job, most efficiently, in digesting our food. So leave off soups, juices, and milks. Now, milk, dairy milk, because of the fact that it has a lot of lactose in it, causes a problem for many people because of inadequate quantities of lactase. I believe that the Lord made us so that we would produce a lot of lactase in infancy. But then as we mature, since of course we're not supposed to be taking milk any longer, eventually we are supposed to be weaned. So, and we're not supposed to be taking much in the way of milk anymore, just maybe a little for flavoring and the like. At that time, the Lord didn't intend for us to need a large quantity of lactase. Lactase is an enzyme to split milk sugar. So at about 18 months to 2 years, the milk sugar in the stomach gradually begins to fall off. And I believe that this is designed by the Lord. It takes a lot of energy to produce this enzyme. So if we need a lot more of this enzyme for digesting a lot of milk, it does put a tax on the body. So the Lord wanted to conserve our energy. He made it so that this enzyme would fall off as we no longer need it in the body. And I think this is a protective mechanism. And a lot of people are very faithful in following that design of the Lord and don't produce lactase. But some of us do produce lactase. Those can drink a lot of milk and into adult life and not be injured by it. But those who I believe are following the Lord's design and not producing a lot of lactase, they can't take a lot of milk without suffering diarrhea or constipation or intestinal gas or some other kind of irritating phenomenon. Milk sensitivity is the commonest food sensitivity in America. And I believe that it has to do with the fact that we introduce dairy milk to children too early in life and that we use it in far greater quantity than is helpful for us. Now, another thing that we could do to improve health is to skip 1 to 4 meals occasionally. If we would do so, this would give the digestive apparatus, both the intestinal tract as well as its auxiliary organs such as liver and pancreas and even the lymph nodes, an opportunity to rest and to recover from that we have done to it in the way of giving it some kind of tax. Now, some of you may wonder, how could I prevent overeating? And I would like to talk with you about a few things. One very important thing is to make a plan. If you have been in the habit of overeating, you can be quite certain that you're going to overeat when you get to the meal unless you make some plan to the contrary. Now, one plan has to do with the availability of food. If there is an abundance of food and you're accustomed to overeating, it's quite likely that you will serve your plate too generously and that you will go back too many times to replenish a plate that was already too full in the beginning. So, here is a plan. Number one, if you're the cook, don't cook too much. Cook simply enough. If there are 8 people going to eat, cook 8 potatoes, that's all. If you cook 8 servings of oatmeal, that's all. Now, you may want to cook twice that much because you may need to have leftover oatmeal for some other dish. If you do, go ahead and take out what quantity you're going to use for that leftover dish. Take out that quantity at the beginning. Put that away. And it's, so far as anyone is concerned who's going to be dining at the present meal, that doesn't even exist because that's for tomorrow's meal. So they don't even know about that. Put that away. Then serve out that you do have. Doing what is called the Russian style of serving is a very good way. That means serving all the major food back in the kitchen, serving it up in the dishes that people are going to eat from. Then serve that on the table. It's a very elegant way of serving. It's also a very protective way, too. Helps people not to overeat. Then it's all served out. You don't have any leftovers. That's another great blessing of the Russian style of serving. You've served out everything. Then if someone is really hungry, you will have bread, and they can eat bread. And good food will satisfy genuine hunger. So if a person is really hungry, they can still eat bread. Now, a second thing, serve your plate with everything that you're going to be eating at that meal. Now, be realistic. Don't take 2 or 3 little carrot curls and a celery stick or so. That won't sustain your life, at least not for very long. So be realistic about what you're going to eat. Serve that out on your plate, but no seconds. That's all. Just go the one time. You have only one go at it, so you get what you want that first time. The beginning of the meal is the time to make this decision. Now, another thing that you can do is to slow your eating pace. Where do we get satisfaction from our food? Down in the stomach? It must be in the stomach because everybody wants to get it down there very quickly. Is that correct? Now, what we want to do if we want to enjoy the food is to allow it to stay a long time in the mouth. So, introduce the food into the mouth and chew it until it becomes a cream in the mouth. As you do that, you will get many benefits from it. You will get a lot more nutrients from it than you could. You will have a lot less fermentation from your food than you would have had. That is important also. So you need to retrain your eating habits, and this takes painstaking effort, and it takes planning ahead of time. Someone said to me yesterday, I don't know what it is about my food, but every time I put some into my mouth, I have a reflex and I swallow it almost immediately. How do you chew it a long time? And I said, you put it in the front part of your mouth and keep it there for a good little while until you have overcome the reflex to swallow. Chew and chew and chew. And as you do that, you will find that you can slow your eating pace. Now, another very important revolutionary thing in custom is this. When you have finished your meal, get up from the table. Don't sit around. Now, if you can only excuse yourself for a few moments, let's say you have guests, excuse yourself for a few moments, go back to your bathroom and brush your teeth. Rinse your mouth well. If you will brush your teeth, when you go back to the table, you will not be so tempted to snack and nibble as you would have been if you had not just freshly gotten a clean mouth. So that can be a great help to you also. Usually, no more than 35 to 40 minutes is needed to complete an ordinary meal, even with adequate chewing. So chew your food well, then leave the table immediately. Another thing, don't have an open end to your meal time. Have a closed end. Have something planned for the end of the time. If you've got 2 hours, a 2-hour break for lunch, you can spend it at the table if you're so inclined. But let's say you decide, I'll leave 35 minutes time and that's all for the meal. Then after that, I've got to be doing something else. So you schedule something. And if you'll have an appointment that you have to meet someone, it's quite likely that you will be willing to cut it short. Or have something planned like a walk or some after-dinner exercise. Get out of the house. The sooner you get out of the house, the sooner you reduce your temptations from the table. So plan that thing that is to occur just after the meal time. When you go to a restaurant, have it planned ahead of time what you're going to eat. Now, you may not know exactly what you're going to select, but let's say you decide, I'm going to select a main dish and one vegetable and one bread serving. Those three things. Now, you may decide on more or you may decide on less. But let's just say those are the three things that you have decided. When you get to the place where you're going to order your meal, you find two or three things that would satisfy for a main dish. There are baked potatoes, there are beans, and perhaps there is a rice dish. So you make a selection. One, you've already decided you're going to have a main dish. That's all, just one. So select one, whichever it's going to be. Then the next thing may be the vegetable. Well, let's say they have squash and green beans and greens. Well, you select one. Don't select all three, just one. That's all. Now, if the server does not serve you as much as you want, ask for two servings. Two servings of greens, please. I'd like two little bowls of greens. So you just ask for that. Then the bread serving. Let's say the bread serving is not all that you want. They give you one tiny little Parker House roll, not big enough for one hearty appetite if you're restricting the number of different foods that you're eating. So say, please give me two rolls. That will be perfectly all right for you to take that kind of serving. Then you take your meal to your table and sit down and enjoy a good meal. Perhaps you will have a salad with that as well. Most meals should have something fresh or raw in them because of the fact that we do need a good supply of vitamin C. Now, let's say that you think, well, I can go that far without having any problem, but I know what is coming up next. I'm going to be so tempted by those little nibbles that are left. Maybe if you're out eating somewhere, you're tempted by some little nibble left on someone else's plate. Order a doggy bag quickly and then pile it all in together. And it is literal that you may not have but a few seconds to control this thing. Because the eyes are so constituted that when they see something that we have an appetite for, we immediately want that. And if we don't take measures, if we do not have strong moral strength, we're going to get that that we have already said we wanted. So we need to be so careful about doing things quickly that we have made a decision on where the appetites are concerned. And this involves all of our appetites, not just that for food. Make a decision. Whatever your decision is, take steps immediately within a matter of seconds to institute a plan that will make it so that you will not fall a prey to that temptation. So if it is food on somebody else's plate, immediately ask for a doggy bag, or at least announce to everyone that you're going to do that. Then start raking it all together with food in such a way that you cannot preserve it in a condition that you could still eat it. Then, if you're at home, don't look at dishes that you have already served yourself from. Don't look at other people's plates to see what may be left. If someone tempts you with something that they bring on late, and you know it is our custom in this country to serve in courses, so we serve in one course, then somebody brings in something else. So your wife brings in something that you did not expect and you're already filled. And she says, honey, I made this coconut pie just for you. Don't look at it. Look right up at her. And say, honey, and you can be gracious. You don't have to get frustrated and annoyed. But look right at her and say, honey, that was so nice, but I could not do justice to it now. Let's save it. And don't look at it. Keep looking at her. If you look at it, you're lost, aren't you? You will not be able to resist. Breathe only through your mouth. Don't breathe through the nose. And in this way, you will be able to resist temptation. Now, I am certain that you can see immediately that this is a way to avoid temptation. Avoid that tempts you. If you cannot avoid it, then turn it off in the imagination. Start thinking of something else. The Bible also says this, if he will cry unto me, I will hear and will answer. Cry out to the Lord. He will hear you and he will answer. You will be impressed with the strength that heaven has. But I would like to say this, that all the power and strength that heaven has to help you to overcome temptation is available to you today. No more is going to be available tomorrow than is available today. Whatever you want in the way of victory in your life, it is more likely that you can attain to that victory today than it is tomorrow. Every time you spurn the graces of heaven that could give you victory and strength, that is one more day that you have strengthened your weaknesses, and we want to strengthen our strengths. May this be the experience of every one of us today.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage you. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.